Welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast. I'm Ian Welsh. Joining me today is Natalie Walker, who's Director of Tropical Forests and Agriculture with the National Wildlife Federation. Welcome to the podcast, Natalie.
Thank you.
Why don't you start off by giving us a bit of background as to what exactly the National Wildlife Federation does?
We are a federation because we have an affiliate in almost every state of the US. All of our offices are in the US. We were established more than 80 years ago to give a voice in Washington to the states. So especially around access to wild places, federal and state level lands, protecting species and habitats. We focus our work on that now, still looking at reversing population decline, addressing the greatest environmental threats, protecting habitats, and also helping future generations in the US. But I work in our international team, and we look at external problems around the world that affect everybody globally. And then we also particularly look at areas where US interests, either through products that come into the US or activities by American companies or financed by American companies, are having an impact on wildlife around the world.
Okay, so your focus is preserving American habitats and landscapes then, but leading on from what you've just said, to what extent do you recognize that to protect American habitats and landscapes, you need to focus on activity outside North America, as environmental problems, the climate crisis being the most obvious, are
yes,
global and not local?
Yes, we absolutely do. We realize that climate change is the greatest threat to wildlife around the world and in the US. And therefore, we need to act globally to address the climate challenge. And we do that in various ways. We have actively participated since Kyoto or pre-Kyoto in supporting action through the UN. We try and focus on the greatest threats to wildlife internationally, both to protect species and also, because we focus on tropical forests play a major role in buffering us against the impacts of climate change, but also deforestation and habitat loss is a major driver of climate change. And so we see it as both given our areas of expertise and interest and also priority, protecting tropical forests have a double impact, right? We protect habitat and wildlife and also can absorb carbon and help be a solution to climate change.
How much has your work been frustrated by the different focus of the federal government?
Our domestic policy work is obviously affected by the changes in regulations that are threatening water, wildlife in the US. Though the core type of work that we do, which is we've always had a broad church, we represent, we have over 6 million members around the US, and we've always been bipartisan, and we look for ways where we can share interests and help protect where we can and make a case to all sides of the political debate for protecting wildlife, for people and wild spaces, and for health. And so, yes, they've been affected. When it comes internationally, our work in the international level is not focused on US policy per se, government policy. So it has not been such a great impact for us.
Are you working then to preserve the US's position within the Paris Agreement?
That would be a great priority, though. In November, the Trump administration has made notice of their intention to exit the agreement. That's a disappointment. We would like to still continue to highlight to all sides of the political debate in the US the importance of the Paris Climate Agreement, and also the fact that some of the concerns are misplaced, that the Paris Agreement allows governments to take action at the national level of their choosing. And so we have made that point and will continue to, that there isn't an unfair playing field because every government can choose what they do. And we'd like to see that happen. Other work that we've been involved in is that there's a lot of work. We work because we are in almost every state in the US. There's a lot of subnational action in the US. And so we also work at local level and the state level to help the US still take action without the federal government. And there's actually a lot that the US can do at the subnational level and also through the private sector. We work with many different American companies and we encourage them to take action and have strong climate targets.
So there's still within the US then a significant weight of opinion that, in fact, as we were saying before, these problems exist and are global in nature and that everyone has to do their part to try and counter them.
Yes, there is. And there's always quite high polling on climate as an issue of concern in the US. So yes, we're trying to help spread awareness and education about that. And also the knowledge that taking action on climate is not all about cost. There's a lot of benefits, green jobs, health benefits, and other side benefits to acting on climate.
All right, let's think a bit more broadly then. To what extent does there need to be a complete reset for business to engage supply chains and value chains within their operations with what's necessary to keep environmental impact within manageable boundaries?
I think it depends what you mean by a reset, because I think a lot of companies have started to take action or they have reasonably good targets. The real gap is on implementation and prioritizing it. I think that there's an awareness that the need to concern themselves with environmental issues is not just to help groups like us or stop us banging at their doors, but also because it's for the long-term sustainability. If you have a model that requires habitat destruction to get cheap food, that's not going to go on forever. So I think there's a realization that long-term economic food security and their business model requires environmental protection. So I don't know if I would call it a reset, but there certainly needs to be a higher priority placed on corporate actions, corporate responsibilities. Firstly, because we know the climate emergency, all of new science is coming out all the time telling us we really don't have time to waste. And then also because there is so much more data available just in the last 5 years since the New York Declaration was signed, almost 6 years now, there's huge amounts of increasing transparency. There's many different tools now available to be able to show companies where they're buying things from. There's a lot more data so we can really understand where the destruction's happening with the fires. You could see pinpoints and exposés about whose farm and who was selling to where. And so there's really not an excuse. You can't be able to hide anymore. And you also can't use the excuse that you don't know. We think that companies need to take much faster and more serious action, but it doesn't necessarily need to be a change to their model. There's a lot of benefits if they do that now. And the sooner they act, the easier and less costly those changes will be.
It strikes me that something that companies can do is help to develop an environment in their operations and their supply chains that is an enabling environment for development. So do you think there's a need to move from, for example, focusing on simply enforcing zero deforestation, for example, but moving towards that enabling environment for sustainable development?
I think you need both. I don't think you can stop the enforcement of zero deforestation for a couple of reasons. First of all, deforestation is the most harmful impact a company that is working in forest risk areas can have. It dwarfs anything else. Secondly, because there is evidence of rebound effects, meaning if you simply enhance yields and support productivity without protecting forests, you get increased deforestation because you're making every hectare of land more valuable financially. And so there's an incentive to clear more land. And so you have to have deforestation targets and policies requiring no deforestation as a prerequisite, in our views, to supporting or undertaking sustainable development. But the two have to go hand in hand. We know that like the biggest challenge we face is to be able to produce enough food in a changing climate without destroying habitat. It's not easy, but there are vast areas of already cleared land available in the tropics as well as outside that's suitable for land expansion. And as I mentioned, some of these tools now, we know where those areas are. And so we believe that efforts should focus on helping support development activities in areas already cleared so that there is a need to pressure forests. But like I said, that won't happen without very strict no deforestation policies from those companies buying from those regions.
And what are the other sorts of incentives that work then to ensure that already developed land is used?
We've been looking at removing barriers, and we've for years done surveys of, we've done more work with ranchers than anyone else, ranchers in Brazil, sort of why aren't they using better methods? There are a number of low-tech methods that can double or triple productivity and actually have a number of carbon benefits. For example, in ranching, especially in the tropics, it's hot, cows are furry, they like shade, can plant trees, forget about deforesting and actually enhance productivity. But the reasons why they're not undertaking them is really a whole slew of things. The lack of technical capacity, they need upfront costs. There's usually quite a short payback period, but they don't have that. And they need better trained workers, which are not readily available in remote areas. So we've been looking at these barriers and trying to find ways to encourage these barriers to be overcome. And there are some really interesting pilot projects that are taking place that are showing that there are multiple win-win-wins when these methodologies are undertaken, because there's improved productivity, it encourages companies to buy, there's improved market access, the land works better, is used better, like I said, there's lower methane when you're using more digestible grasses. And so there's a lot of benefits, and trained workers enjoy what they're doing, they're proud of what they're doing. Some of these projects like to start by a road because they like to show their neighbours what they're doing. They're proud of the results.
These pilot projects you talk about, are they ones that can be scaled up?
Yes, they can, though there are some upfront costs that are going to be required. And there are some efforts underway to try and help provide those. There's been some announcements recently, for example, in the soy sector, of some funding that will support deforestation-free or habitat conversion-free production. And there's a number of other efforts to try and support them. So, yeah, scaling up is absolutely possible. There's nothing to stop it, but there's some need for technical support as well as financial.
Always some barriers to scaling up successful pilot projects, but I guess we've all got to try to work through those and trying to make sure that they do become the potential solutions in the future. But for now, Natalie Walker from the National Wildlife Federation, thank you very much.
Thank you.